the former Trump aide knew his conduct was unlawful or wrong. His attorneys say the combined force of Bannon's arguments demonstrate that he did not know his defiance was unlawful and shifts the burden onto the Justice Department to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Steve Bannon did not believe the privilege claims were valid. The former Trump aide Steve Bannon is also coupling the argument that the subpoena was invalid with the defenses that he relied on the advice of counsel when he defied the subpoena and that he cannot be prosecuted because Office of Legal Counsel opinions considered binding on the Justice Department forbid it. Bannon's attorneys say the former Trump aide ignored his subpoena entirely on the advice of Bob Costello, who relied on the Office of Legal Counsel opinions about immunity for former presidential aides and was the only point of contact with the Select Committee during negotiations about his cooperation. It is far from clear whether Steve Bannon will prevail. In a recent hearing, Judge Nichols cast doubt on the advice of counsel argument, noting that the relevant case law, Licavoli v. United States, 1961, holds that relying on legal advice to defy a subpoena is no defense. The Justice Department argued in their brief that the interpretation of willful should in fact remain the standard established by the Licavoli Court, a deliberate and intentional failure to appear or produce records as required by a congressional subpoena. But Steve Bannon's lawyers have noted that the Licavoli case did not involve executive privilege and therefore does not apply to Steve Bannon, not least because the Justice Department has itself maintained that executive privilege cases are unique because of the constitutional implications. Professor Shoup said of Steve Bannon, "He's reaching for all the straws that he can. It may succeed or it may not, but if Judge Nichols rules against him, he's certainly going to take it to the D.C. Circuit or even up to the Supreme Court. He's definitely playing a longer game here."
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Now, this week, we are focusing on the diplomatic ties between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Republic of Kenya. These two great nations have enjoyed cordial ties that have continued to improve over the years. To discuss this, we are joined by two special guests. In the studio here, we have His Excellency Joshua Getimu, the ambassador of the Republic of Kenya to Iran, and joining us via video link is His Excellency Jafar Barmaki, the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Kenya. Stay with us till the end of the program. And as I told you earlier, here in our studio in Tehran, we have His Excellency Joshua Getimu, the ambassador of the Republic of Kenya to Iran. Thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador.
Thank you, Mubarak, for this opportunity.
And joining us from Kenya via video link is His Excellency Jafar Barmaki, the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Kenya. Thank you very much, Ambassador Jafar Barmaki, for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for it, David. Invitation.
And now, before we proceed with our discussion, let's listen to a brief introduction of our subject today.
this year marks 50 years since the establishment of diplomatic ties between Iran and Kenya. These ties witnessed tremendous progress following the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. These two countries enjoy historical ties that continue to thrive to the present times. Kenya and Iran are both strategically located and enjoy diverse markets. This creates immense potential for cooperation when it comes to complementing each other's requirements in imports and export arenas.
Now, let's start with you here in the studio, Ambassador Joshua Gatimu. Now, can you briefly elaborate to us on the current level of ties between Kenya and Iran?
Thank you, Mubarak. And what I can say is that the two countries, Kenya and Iran, have enjoyed warm and cordial relations within the framework of the Kenya-Iran Joint Commission for Cooperation, JCC, of 2014. And further, the two countries have concluded several agreements and a memorandum of understanding. Mm-hmm. Some of them include, for example, the Official Development Assistance, ODA, credit line facility, and agricultural cooperation. Mm-hmm. Though we have done this, there is more we can do to review the signed agreements and MOUs between the two countries, as many of them remain pending. Some have lapsed, and we hope that come June this year, we will be holding the 7th Kenya-Iran Joint Commission for Cooperation. In Nairobi, in Kenya, we will be hosting. That will enrich our bilateral relationship further.
Now, to you, Ambassador Barmaki, can you also briefly elaborate now on the historical aspect of ties between Kenya and Iran?
Yeah, Mubarak, you may know very well that the Iranian travel to this part of the world, I mean East Africa, especially through Mombasa, almost four centuries ago, when they appeared to be here along with Omanis to help the local people of Mombasa to get rid of the oppression of the Portuguese who were here for some decades. Therefore, it was almost 1662 that the Iranian visited this part of the world and helped the local people in overcoming the operations from the big powers at that time. And the second, in fact, migration from the Iranian was in 1820, which again the Baluchi from Iran migrated here, and they helped a lot in developing the coastal area of Kenya.
Thank you very much for that insight. Now, Ambassador Joshua Gatimu, what is the importance of the economic and trade ties between the two countries, and where are we moving to right now?
Thank you, Barak. I think as we have heard from my colleague in Kenya, trade relations between the two countries started a long time ago. With the Iranians, at that time called Persians, Oman Arabs, coming to our coastal towns for business. Mm-hmm. So it's something that has been going on for a long time. And as years passed on, we have continued with the same trade between the two countries. And the most of the commodities traded in, for example, from our country, you find that we have tea ranks among the most important one. Then coffee, and of late I think there is special liking for coffee in Iran amongst the youth, and we are noting that. And also horticultural products to this country. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I think it is good to emphasize that though it has been minimal for some years because of sanctions on Iran, which we hope they will come to an end quite soon, we are still determined to continue with the trade between the two countries.
Mm-hmm.
And from here, I can tell you, we have been getting a lot of petroleum products from Iran.
Yeah.
And I can also say that we have many Iranian business people in Kenya. With doing big business. So we are connected economically with Iran.
Now, back to you, Ambassador Barmaki. Now, following the victory of the Islamic Revolution, what are some of the milestones which have been achieved in the Kenya-Iran ties?
If I want to refer to the milestones in the relations, I can refer to the visit of the high levels at the presidential level between two countries that helped a lot in expanding the relations, not only at the presidential level, but also at the ministerial and the vice president level. This is one part which is mostly political, but I can refer to one of the activities of our embassy here in Nairobi that refers to 1 year back, which is establishing and putting up the Iran House of Innovation and Technology in Nairobi, which is a very good help to the startups and on those companies who are knowledge-based in Kenya and in Iraq. That House of Innovation and Technology is of the Iranian knowledge. They are ready to present technologies to the Kenyan market. This house, which we call Aviation IHI, ready to, and at the moment is doing the Kenyan startups in come up with new ideas to commercialize and also finance to send it to the market. These are in political and in economic aspects that I can refer to between two countries. But we are still looking for lots of activities to do, and I hope in coming year I can have good news for you in expanding the relations between two countries that you can consider as milestones in the relations.
Thank you very much for that. Now, Ambassador Getimu, here in Tehran, since you arrived and started your mission, what steps have you taken to, you know, boost the trade and economic ties between Kenya and Iran?
Thank you, Mubarak, for that question. And since my arrival here, almost 1 year ago now, I think in April 13th, I will be 1 year in Tehran.
Oh, wonderful.
And since my arrival here, there have been delegations and delegations from Nairobi of business people. Thanks to my colleague in Nairobi for the support. They have been coming here to look for business opportunities. And I can tell you, during this period, we have had two very important meetings, two in Nairobi, for example, last year. And the another one recently in Naivasha, whereby we had a virtual meeting with the people, business people from Iran, some attending the meeting. And really, Kenyans are anxious. They are ready to go to explore what they can get from here and what they can bring to this part of the world.
Oh, so we look forward to a great future in terms of trade.
We look forward to a great interaction as far as business and other activities are concerned.
Now, Ambassador Barmaki, away from business and economic issues, now, what are some of the humanitarian projects and development projects Iran is implementing in Kenya?
If I go back to the records, I can tell you that most of the these developmental and humanitarian assistance to Kenya was belonging before 2015. That according to the records, there were several projects in different parts of the country which amounted to more than $5 million that we financed different projects for different parts, especially the remote areas, on different issues like on water, sanitations, on building the schools, and some other matters that were very necessary for that part of the country.
Now, we'll take a short break, viewers, and when we come back, we shall continue our discussion on the Kenya-Iran ties. Stay with us.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back to Africa Today. We have a special program today on the diplomatic ties between Kenya and Iran, which are marking 50 years since their inception. Now, in the studio here, we have Ambassador Joshua Getimu, the ambassador of the Republic of Kenya to Iran, and also joining us by a video link from Kenya is His Excellency Jafar Barmaki, the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Kenya. Now, Ambassador Getimu, as you mentioned earlier, it's almost 1 year since you arrived in Iran. Can you tell us how did you find the country and what has been your experience over the last few months here?
Thank you, Mubarak. And I will be very honest in this one. Apart from what I was read in history a long time ago about the Persian Gulf, you know, the conquerors and so forth. Before I came here, the information about Iran is out there normally is not the correct one. So I remember some people would ask us, and my family and my spouse when we were coming. You people aren't too afraid of that place. Because the people think that Iran, especially Tehran, is very insecure. Because of the propaganda.
The propaganda, Western media propaganda,
But when we arrived here and looked around, the streets and everything, to me it looked like any other street in Europe.
Oh, great.
Those old streets, you know, with the carburetor, the tires and so forth. And very civilized people. People looking, who look like, in fact, Western people from the Western world. So, my earlier
perception
changed. And I've come to find out that the Iranians are very good with people. Very kind. And they are working.
Oh, great to know that.
Maybe in our country, because we are also hardworking, maybe we borrow some few traits from these parts of the world. So it's a country to be in. and with their long history, because they have a long history, there is a lot we can learn from this country. In matters of technology, for example, new methods, even, you know, we are an agricultural state country, we can learn a lot about agriculture from here. And as I said about business and so forth, it's really a country that I really intend to build up the relations for the betterment of the people of the two countries.
Thank you. Now, Ambassador Barmaki, as you noted earlier, the historical ties between Kenya and Iran, or actually Iran and the whole of East Africa, have been there for hundreds of years. Now, what is being done to sustain these people-to-people relations between the two nations?
If I look at the activities of the embassy we have done in different areas, with especially in last 1 year, I can tell you that the coordination between two embassies, I mean the Kenyan embassy in Tehran and the Iranian embassy, they had very good relations that rarely can find in the previous relations between two embassies.
Yeah.
And we were very successful in supporting each other. As His Excellency Gatimu referred to, it was for the first time in our relation that in last 1 year, we had 11 delegations exchanged between two countries.
Ambassador Barmaki, our last question to you. Now, recently, there was a United Nations Environment Assembly held in Nairobi, and which voted to end plastic pollution. Can you tell us about the assembly and Iran's participation in this important global summit?
Yeah, thank you, Mubarak. Let me give some introduction on what I do here beside ambassadorial level to Kenya and bilateral. I am also the permanent representative of Iran to United Nations office in Nairobi.
Yeah.
Maybe the audience doesn't know that we have two specialized agencies of the United Nations here, which called United Nations Environment Program and United Nations Human Settlement.
Yeah.
These two are the headquarters are in Nairobi, and the only headquarters of the United Nations in a developing country. And this is why Kenya is also very important, Nairobi.
Mm-hmm.
In that area, this year we had the United Nations Environment Assembly, the fifth session here, which held every 2 years. And one of the important resolutions which has been adopted was on plastic pollution. And Iran was the co-sponsor, along with the other countries, on this resolution. We succeeded to adopt this resolution in UNIA. And it is going to be to put up an international negotiating committee in 2022 to start preparing a text as a new multilateral environmental agreement on plastic pollution, the whole life of plastic production from designing to disposal. And it is very important, and although it is very difficult, but we hope that by 2024 we are in a situation to conclude and to adopt the text as a new MEA. And Iran also has been elected from the regional group, Asia regional group, as the vice president to next session of UNIA, and that can help a lot in conducting the negotiation on plastic pollution resolution, which is going to be in next 2 years. Therefore, Iran can play a good role in that, because we have the same position as the vice president for next 2 years in the Bureau of UNIAS 6, United Nations Environment Assembly 6.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Jafar Barmaki, for your time. It's been really great having you. And we hope to have more such conversations in future on the ties between these two great nations.
Can I add something, Mubarak, if you have time?
Yeah.
As I mentioned, I am in Mombasa now. I'm here to open the Balochistan Museum, one of the embassy activity in the 50th anniversary of the diplomatic relations between two countries.
Yeah.
In this day afternoon, we are going to open Baluchi Museum, which has been put up in very close collaboration with the Baluchi community in Mombasa and the Iranian embassy in Nairobi. And I hope that I can send you some short video clips from the opening so you can add to your program.
Definitely. Thank you very much, Your Excellency. Ambassador Joshua Getimbu, before we wind up, now, where do you see the Iran-Kenya ties in the next 4 years before the end of your mission?
To be frank, Mubarak, I expect to see more interaction between the political leadership at the top, the business people between the two countries, and the ordinary Kenyans. Those are my expectations.
Thank you very much, Your Excellency, Ambassador Joshua Getimbu, for your time and for accepting our invitation.
Thank you very much, Mubarak.
Well, and that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. Goodbye for now.
With the spring, the season of renewal and freshness, and the greening of nature, we here at IRIB English Radio wish you happiness, prosperity, and good health.
In the limelight.
Recently, the New York Times reported a Manhattan prosecutor who investigated Donald Trump's financial dealings wrote in a resignation letter that he believed Trump is guilty of numerous felony violations and blasted the new district attorney for not moving ahead with an indictment. We have prepared for you an article written by Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Trump Sues Hillary Clinton, Alleging Plot to Rig 2016 Election Against Him. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has sued Hillary Clinton, the Democratic National Committee, and other people and entities tied to the investigation of Russian election interference in 2016, claiming that, in a bid to rig the election, they orchestrated a conspiracy which made Watergate pale in comparison. The lawsuit came a day after the release of a letter from a prosecutor in New York who said he believed Donald Trump was guilty of numerous felony violations in his business affairs, despite the district attorney in Manhattan choosing not to indict him. Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton for the presidency in 2016. Nevertheless, 6 years on, he alleges she is guilty of racketeering and a conspiracy to commit injurious falsehood, among other claims. The 108-page lawsuit follows lawsuits filed by Trump and allies in the aftermath of the 2020 presidential election, charging Joe Biden's victory was the result of electoral fraud. Out of 62 such lawsuits, only one succeeded. Among those also listed as defendants in the new lawsuit are ex-FBI officials James Comey, Andrew McCabe, Peter Strzok, and Lisa Page. The former British spy Christopher Steele, author of a famous dossier on Donald Trump's links to Moscow. Also, Jake Sullivan, now National Security Advisor to Joe Biden. And John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign chair. The lawsuit was filed in the U.S. District Court in the Southern District of Florida by lawyers from the state and Alina Haber, a New Jersey attorney who represented Trump in failed lawsuits seeking to block investigation of the deadly Capitol riot on 6th of January 2021, which Donald Trump fueled with lies about electoral fraud. Those lawsuits have widely been seen as delaying tactics, meant to help Trump wait out the 6th of January committee until Republicans can retake the House of Representatives this November and kill the investigation. According to the Daily Beast, other attorneys for Donald Trump have complained about Haber's work. Russia denies interfering in the 2016 U.S. election to boost Donald Trump. The U.S. intelligence community claims that Russia did interfere. Robert Mueller, the special counsel who investigated the matter, did not establish collusion between Trump and Russia, but did list 10 instances in which the then president, Donald Trump, may have tried to obstruct justice. Robert Mueller, who explicitly said he was not exonerating Trump, also claimed several connections between Trump aides and Moscow. In August of 2020, a Senate Intelligence Committee report detailed links between Paul Manafort, Donald Trump's campaign manager for part of the 2016 presidential race, and Russian intelligence operatives. Paul Manafort was jailed on charges of fraud. Donald Trump pardoned him. Regardless, Trump's new lawsuit claims that in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election, Hillary Clinton and her cohorts orchestrated an unthinkable plot, one that shocks the conscience and is an affront to the nation's democracy. The lawsuit alleges, acting in concert, the defendants maliciously conspired to weave a false narrative that their Republican opponent, Donald J. Trump, was colluding with a foreign country. The lawsuit claims the conspiracy involved falsifying evidence, deceiving law enforcement, and exploiting access to highly sensitive data sources in a plot so outrageous, so subversive and incendiary that even the events of Watergate pale in comparison. It claims Hillary Clinton and her fellow defendants nefariously sought to sway the public's trust and work together with a single self-serving purpose to vilify Donald J. Trump. According to the lawsuit, the deception, malice, and treachery perpetrated by the defendants has caused significant harm to the American people and to the plaintiff, Donald J. Trump, and they must be held accountable for their heinous acts. The lawsuit seeks punitive damages, costs, and such further and other relief as this court may deem just and proper. It says Trump has sustained significant injuries and damages, including but not limited to expenses in the form of defense costs, legal fees, and related expenses incurred in an amount no less than $24 million and continuing to accrue, as well as the loss of existing and future business opportunities. Eddie Honig, a former federal prosecutor, now an analyst for CNN, says, "It's difficult to put into words just how deeply flawed and utterly hopeless this lawsuit is." Philip Raines, a former Clinton spokesperson named in the lawsuit, pointed to how damaging an actual trial could be for Donald Trump when he tweeted, "I look forward to deposing the plaintiff." A lawyer for Peter Sturzok, the FBI agent who was fired for sending messages critical of Donald Trump, told the Politico website, "We haven't had a chance to read the complaint, but knowing the former president, there's probably very little in there that's true." Recently, the New York Times reported a Manhattan prosecutor who investigated Donald Trump's financial dealings wrote in a resignation letter that he believed Trump is guilty of numerous felony violations, and blasted the new district attorney for not moving ahead with an indictment of Donald J. Trump. Mark Pomerantz and Kerry Dunn, two top prosecutors on the Manhattan District Attorney's criminal investigation of Trump, resigned abruptly last month amid reports that the investigation into the former president's finances was foundering. The newly elected district attorney, Alvin Bragg, was reportedly more skeptical than his predecessor that the evidence his office's attorneys had gathered against Trump would be enough to convict him. In a February resignation letter obtained by the New York Times, Pomerantz wrote that the team of lawyers investigating Donald Trump had no doubt he had committed crimes, and that Alvin Bragg's decision not to move ahead with prosecuting Trump will doom any future prospects that Trump will be prosecuted for the criminal conduct we have been investigating. Mark Pomerantz reportedly wrote, "His financial statements were false, and he has a long history of fabricating information relating to his personal finances and lying about his assets to banks, the national media, counterparties, and many others, including the American people." The clock is ticking on the case against Donald Trump as the current term of the grand jury, which has been hearing evidence, expires in April. Ronald Fischetti, an attorney for Donald Trump, told The Guardian that the resignation letter simply reflected the prosecuting team's failure to make a convincing legal case against the former president, describing his client's innocence. Ronald Fischetti said, "Mark Pomerantz had several occasions to meet with Alvin Bragg, the district attorney, and his senior staff to lay out exactly what he intended to present to the grand jury in order to get an indictment, and he failed. He was unable to convince the district attorney and his senior staff that he had sufficient evidence to warrant an indictment." Ronald Fischetti said, "Alvin Bragg should be commended for not doing this on the basis of politics and just doing it on the basis of law, which he's supposed to do." While the resignation letter conceded that the case against Donald Trump could be challenging and that there were risks of bringing it to court, it argued that there was a strong public interest in prosecuting Donald Trump, even if a conviction is not certain. Mark Pomerantz reportedly wrote that former Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance, who had been deeply involved in the case, had directed the team to present evidence to a grand jury and to seek an indictment of Donald Trump, and other defendants as soon as reasonably possible. But Alvin Bragg, who was sworn in this January, reviewed the case and did not agree. Mark Pomerantz believed Bragg's decision not to seek an indictment of Trump was made in good faith, but also misguided and completely contrary to the public interest. Mark Pomerantz did not respond to a request for comment. Danielle Filson, a spokesperson for the district attorney, wrote in an email, "The investigation continues. A team of experienced prosecutors is working every day to follow the facts and the law. There is nothing we can or should say at this juncture about an ongoing investigation." A spokesperson for the Trump Organization called Mark Pomerantz a never-Trumper in a statement to the New York Times. Some in the Republican Party leadership reportedly feared Donald Trump's grip on the party and fixation on Hillary Clinton, 2016, and supposed electoral fraud could cost the GOP dearly in elections this year and in 2024. In legal jeopardy over his business affairs and attempted political subversion, Donald Trump has all but declared he will run for the White House again. Speaking to reporters in Brussels, Belgium recently, President Biden said of the 2024 presidential election, "I'd be very fortunate if I had the same man running against me."
During the Vietnam War, the U.S. military engaged in an aggressive program of chemical warfare codenamed Operation Ranch Hand. Now, from 1961 to 1971, the U.S. military sprayed a range of herbicides across more than 4.5 million acres of Vietnam to destroy the forest cover and food crops used by North Vietnamese. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. Agent Orange, which contains the deadly chemical dioxin, was the most commonly used herbicide. It was later proven to cause serious health issues, including cancer, birth defects, rashes, and severe psychological and neurological problems. But the Vietnamese were not the only ones affected. U.S. soldiers unknowingly brought the legacy of Agent Orange back home. Join us for this week's Aperture as we meet three children of U.S. veterans who fall victim to Agent Orange and follow them as they travel to Vietnam to face their demons. Here's the first part.
All I ever heard was war stories about how horrible it was and how violent everything was and that there was just death and destruction, and that's the picture that was painted in my head of what Vietnam was. And it scared me half to death when I was getting ready to come over here, to the point where I was actually shaking on the plane on my way here because I did not know what to expect.
Traveling here, someone said, you know, Heather travels back to the land of her father's demons. Vietnam is still a very scary, dangerous place to them.
I was actually very nervous and very scared. Several of my father's friends kind of scared me about some of the things that I may see and hear and experience. Their vision of Vietnam was a war-torn, angry place.
Do you guys have any bottled water before we get going, just in case?
My name is Josh Kelly. I was born on August 18th, 1975.
My name is Heather Bowser. My maiden name is Morris.
My name is Rachel Harding. I was born in northern Indiana near Chicago.
My dad was Daniel Kelly. He was in the U.S. Marine Corps, and he fought in Vietnam.
my parents had married 9 days before he had left for Vietnam. They said that, you know, if they had 9 days being together, that's what they wanted to do.
My father got his draft papers when he turned 18 and chose to marry my mother before he left. They got married, and 2 weeks later, he was deployed to Vietnam.
I've been trying to find out what exactly happened when he was there, because when I was younger, I tried to block the stories out because some of them were so scary and so violent and all that, that I just tried to not even listen to them because I didn't want to hear it, because they scared the bottom of me because I was just a kid.
When they came home, they wanted to put the war behind them. The Vietnam War was a very difficult political time, civil rights time, and so wanting to put it behind them, start their family and move on.
As soon as he came home, they chose to wait to have children. They waited about 7 years before they decided to try, and I was the firstborn. String's already broken, and he doesn't really care. It keeps changing fast. It don't last too long.
The Colorado Rocky Mountain High. So my mother had two miscarriages. She lost two children. And no one in our family had had any kind of problems in that respect. So it was very unexpected. And then in 1972, my mother was pregnant again and felt that she had gone into labor early. She was not due for a while. They went to the hospital. She had already lost two children, so she was very scared. She thought she might be miscarrying again at the very late time in the pregnancy. They rushed her into the hospital, and she said, I'm in labor. And she was very thin, and they kind of said, no, you're okay. It's okay. You're going to be all right. You're not in labor. You barely look pregnant. She was 7 months along at that point. My mother woke up to my father sitting at her bedside telling her, and it's hard to talk about, but he said, Sharon, she's damaged. And that's what she woke up to. So I can only imagine how scary that was.
The doctors, as soon as I was born, they took me from my mom and they put me in a little incubator, and then they rushed me off out of the room. They didn't explain anything to my mom. They just said that there was problems.
Various doctors approached my mother at different times and asked what she had done to her child. What had she done to cause such terrible problems?
They brought her over to show me to her for about 5 minutes, and then they put me on an airplane and they flew me to another state, and they kept me in the incubator and they put me in intensive care, and they had all kinds of doctors looking at me and checking to see if I was gonna live or die or what the deal was, because missing my arms and my leg, they weren't sure what all was wrong with me. They started to take me to the doctors and stuff out there, and because they were big hospitals and there was lots of doctors from around the world and everything, they wanted to try a whole bunch of different surgeries and stuff that were like experimental surgeries that nobody had ever tried before. Like, one of them was that they wanted to grow my arms back, and the way that they were going to do it is they were going to cut the skin open, break the bone, and then they were going to drill holes through it and put screws in it and put plates to separate the bone, and the bone would grow in between the gaps. And they said that it could take up to 5 to 10 years for my arms to finish growing back, and that it would be an extremely painful.
I want to go back to real quick to one memory I had in kindergarten. We were learning about our hands. This is your left hand, this is your right hand. And it's always a memory that I kind of laugh about. I love school. I couldn't wait to go to school. I was so excited. I wanted to read and do that stuff. So we're sitting in this circle, and the little children are sitting there, and I can just remember this to this day. And there was like a board on the floor, and it had a picture, an outline of a hand and another hand. And each child was to go around and take their turn and say, this is my left hand, this is my right hand, this is my left hand, this is my right hand. And so I remember just being anxious and excited to do my turn. And I went to put my hand in, and I just, at that moment, I was like, oh, okay. Because they had the outline, and my fingers didn't match the outline. And I was like, huh, okay, this is my left hand, this is my right hand, but they don't look like that left hand and that right hand. And that was kind of like, okay, I'm different. That's different.
Pretty much all my life, as far back as I can remember, I knew I was different because I was always going to the doctors. And I would always see the other kids playing and stuff, and I couldn't really go play with them because I either had doctor's appointments or they didn't want anything to do with me.
I have lost 19 children. I never carried more longer than 8.5 weeks, and I would lose my children. I have hypothyroidism, the infertility issue, and psoriatic arthritis. Those are the three biggest ones that I have that affect my life personally. And my family could not understand, my father included, could not understand, where did this come from? Nobody else in the family's ever had this. How come you're suffering from this and nobody else ever has?
I've seen lots of different kids that had disabilities and stuff from being like in the hospitals and stuff all the time. And some of them are so similar that it would have to be from the same thing. The similarities in our disabilities is so much alike, there's no way to deny that it was the same thing that caused both of them.
These are the structural formulas for 2,4-dichlorophenoxyacetic acid, commonly known as 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T. From these chemicals are made a large number of closely related compounds, which are sold commercially for weed and brush control. The Secretary of Defense initiated a project to determine whether visibility in troublesome jungle vegetation in the Republic of Vietnam could be improved by aerially applied chemical sprays. In that country, jungle growth, swamp foliage, and roadside vegetation retains its leaves the year around. Consequently, it affords ideal concealment to guerrilla terrorists who sporadically attack the free people of Vietnam. As a result of these tests, defoliation spraying was placed on an operational basis. Those chemicals already proven most effective as defoliants will continue to be used until faster acting types.
So my father says that he said that there was spraying of his base pretty regularly. I found out since that his base was practically sprayed every day, and that is also due to its proximity to Benoit. Benoit was the epicenter of where Ranch Hand worked out of. So if they had anything left on their missions, they came around that area and used it. The perimeter was hand sprayed, aerial spraying with the C-123 planes.
My dad was in the U.S. Marine Corps. He was stationed in the Chulai Air Base. And while he was there, he was exposed to lots of Agent Orange. They sprayed it on everything. It was in the food, it was in the water, it was on their clothes, it was on the plants, it was on the guns, the ammo, everything had Agent Orange on it. So he was heavily exposed to Agent Orange.
North Vietnam charged today that defoliants have produced many instances of miscarriages, congenital defects, and monstrosities among children.
As we anticipated, the Vietnamese doctors that we've met with very much share our concerns about the effects of Agent Orange.
Although that war was long ago, there is lingering anger about the United States' use of a controversial defoliant spread by American aircraft on the jungles there.
Milton Ross, a special forces advisor near Pleiku, has a son born without the tips of his fingers.
Frank Moore is nearly dead from cancer. He thinks the cancer was caused by chemical defoliants he was exposed to as a soldier in Vietnam.
My dad explained to me about how dangerous the stuff was because it would kill off big old trees and everything in just a couple of days. He would tell me the stories about how he would have to mix it and he would have to load it into the tanks and he would put the tanks on the planes and the helicopters and everything while he was in the war.
It's still causing trouble and all of the people that have lost their lives to Agent Orange, and this is kind of where it began. So it's very sad.
We found out that the rate of miscarriages, fetal death in utero, and birth defects are 4 times higher than in the exposed, among the exposed, than the non-exposed. We have carried out some more studies. I am now very sure, certain, that toxic chemicals cause many things to my people, to the exposed people. Cannot deny.
Yes, exactly.
Cannot deny the relationship between dioxin with the abnormal outcome of pregnancy. Yeah. Among the exposed people.
After the wartime, I mean, after 75, his dad came back here and they have the first child. But due to the Agent Orange, she or he died after 10 days. The biggest child of the family is a normal child because he was born before the time that the dad came to the army.
But do you know in America who carries the pain of Agent Orange? The veterans who serve. The veterans feel responsible.
Yes.
Our fathers felt responsible
for us.
Even for in Vietnam. I mean, they felt responsible. The soldier, not the chemical companies or the
government.
The government that made the decisions.
So my father felt extreme guilt. He felt like he had caused my birth defects. He had told my mother that every time he looked at me, he felt that it was his responsibility. He had caused this to me. And that's a major problem in the United States, trying to work through the Agent Orange issue, is that the veterans feel extreme guilt.
The man that my mom knew from the time she was four did not come home from Vietnam. He's still wandering around in the jungle somewhere. He came home a very angry man, very sad man.
My dad was suffering more and more from his PTSD. He was having other health issues and he was getting weak and he couldn't do the things that he could do before, and his health was just going downhill.